This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Northern Kentucky University political scientist Michael Baranowski. My guest today is Nicholas Dirks, Chancellor of UC Berkeley from 2013 through 2017. Professor Dirks has had a long and distinguished career in academia and academic administration, and is the author of multiple books, the latest of which is City of Intellect, The Uses and Abuses of the University, which we'll be discussing today. Professor Dirks, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Michael.
So you have been at the upper levels of academic administration for a long time, but you started out as historical anthropologist. And I was wondering how you feel that that academic background has sort of influenced how you see, how you understand the challenges that are facing higher education today.
Of course, that's a great question to begin with, since indeed I did not anticipate nor actually work towards becoming an academic administrator when I entered the academy many, many years ago. I studied India, South Asia, and I began studying history rather than anthropology. But when I went to graduate school, the person who was teaching the history of India was an anthropologist by training. So I got kind of sucked into a joint disciplinary program that itself was part of even a larger interdisciplinary group under the kind of general rubric of area studies. And area studies brought together people from literary and cultural studies disciplines, along with social scientists, and really tried to take a holistic view of a part of the world. So I was very interdisciplinary, and that was certainly part of being a historical anthropologist, to go into academic administration when I did it with the idea that, you know, bringing together people who work in different kinds of departments, programs, siloed centers, and the like would be a good thing, and something that I had both commitment to and some experience of. And the other thing, of course, was that it, by virtue of the fact that I had spent so much time in and been part of setting up programs related to the study of South Asia, I was very committed to a kind of global footprint for universities, and so worked towards that in all the different kinds of administrative roles I played. So, you know, both the interdisciplinary side and the global side. But the last part of it, I guess, is that when you think about the two disciplines of history and anthropology, both of them deal with difference across time and across space. And so I began with a sense that institutions do in fact change over time, and they also change by virtue of different kinds of cultural and social conditions. So I was not averse to the idea that universities might have to continue to change and not just hold on to the things that doubtless made them great in the past, but perhaps didn't position them very well for the future.
Certainly, we have seen a lot of change in each of our respective careers, yours being longer than mine. And yeah, you know, it seems like there are just a torrent of books in the last few years about higher ed, the problems with higher ed, how to maybe address some of these problems. And so you've written a book about higher ed, though it's a different sort of book. I'm just kind of curious about how you see, or what you hope for City of Intellect to sort of contribute to this body of work?
So, as you say, I mean, City of Intellect is a little different than the kind of standard issue, you know, higher education is on in flames, you know, what to do to solve it. And I specifically didn't want to have one of those subtitles where I would promise that I would come up with all the solutions for, you know, whatever it is, although I was invited to do that by different publishers. But my book is intended to really do a couple of things. One is to draw people in, to draw readers in to some of the experiences I had as a student, as a professor, as chair of a department, as a dean of the faculty, and ultimately as a chancellor, by telling stories of my different kinds of experiences and the kinds of things that I was engaged in, both things that I feel very proud about and things that were deeply frustrating. And I try to be as honest as I can be about the ups and downs, and there were both. And they were sometimes quite intense. So that's one thing. And the idea here is not so much to write a personal memoir, but to use personal stories to draw readers into the kind of complexity of the issues and the contradictions that really are part of, you know, any effort to diagnose and then recommend solutions for some of the challenges in higher education. But the second thing is that I did want to draw from that, use that personal experience as a kind of spine for thinking both historically and in terms of the future about what we might be able to do to shift the framework, to shift the kind of conversation that we're having about everything from the value of the humanities and undergraduate education to the importance of thinking about these questions around cost and accessibility in a serious way that doesn't give up on the idea that, you know, you want to have the best possible kind of experience and the best possible education at the same time that you don't want it to be reserved solely for people who are very, very wealthy or attend, you know, just the few very, very wealthy colleges and universities that I'm sure we'll go on to talk about.
One of the really valuable things I feel, because I've read a bunch of these books or sometimes just paged through them when I couldn't bear reading the whole thing. But what I feel makes your book both different and valuable is that first part of the book where you take the reader through your career. Because for me, it really brings home an understanding this, that a university is more than one thing. And I feel like so often in our discussions about higher education, people tend to approach institutions of higher education as one thing. And as you go throughout your career, it's clear how your perspective shifts when you have to go from the perspective of a student to a faculty member to an administration to upper administration. And I feel like one of the real problems we struggle with when we talk about higher ed is that it's not just one thing. And unless someone can have that sort of multi-area understanding of it, it's really sort of hard to talk about solutions when we don't even know what a university is in its entirety.
Well, I can't claim that I talk about all the differences and the entire picture of higher education, but I have had, you know, different kinds of not only positions in universities, but I've worked at both public and private universities and universities that focused, you know, like Caltech, where I had my first teaching job on science and engineering, and universities that have been known for a core curriculum in relationship to an undergraduate education like Columbia. But my sense is that we really do have to do two things. One, understand that university administrators, you know, who often are vilified because they're seen as either, you know, the ones who are answering questions in a completely inadequate way when called up to congressional inquiries, as we saw last December, or they're the ones who are, you know, sort of pursuing corporatist interests or just accumulating money in the endowment and then making cuts when they claim there are budget crises and the like. You know, I moved into academic administration because I was trying to, you know, get some things done and do some things that I was interested in, and I had the opportunities to do that. And in the beginning, I didn't see myself as kind of, you know, taking off my white hat, putting on a black hat, or going into the dark side in the kind of way that academics joke about academic administration. But I did have to begin to change the way I looked at things, and it when I moved to different offices, I saw the university from different perspectives. And I did want to share that in the book. But I also, and this is the second thing I'll say in relationship to this, I also saw the tyranny of the rankings and the ways in which things like the U.S. News and World Report rankings of colleges and universities impose a kind of standard set of metrics on all institutions of higher education in a way that has become pretty pervasive and has meant that many colleges and universities actually try to just up their rankings, up their position on the rankings charts by following the same metrics and trying to check the boxes that everybody else is trying to check. So I also here am writing about the need to embrace difference and to accept the fact that different kinds of institutions should serve different kinds of populations, teach different kinds of subjects, think about how they're organized in different kinds of ways, and begin to think about the larger ecosystem of higher education in a different way so that, you know, community colleges are seen as every bit as valuable as the flagship public universities. And in turn, the great public universities that serve more regional or local populations, every bit as important and in some respects excellent as the Ivy League, where, you know, of course, all the attention seems to focus.
You know, there was one, I don't recall where it was in the book, but it really struck me when you were writing about, I think, your experiences in administration, and you said something, wrote something to the effect of, oftentimes what people pushing for change don't fully appreciate is sort of how constrained people in positions of so-called power are, and how difficult it can be with all the cross pressures. And it struck me that that's not just a lesson for university administration, but in general for people in these positions of so-called power, that oftentimes you really are much more constrained than people telling you, well, just do this and it'll all be better, actually really understand.
Yeah, thanks for alluding to that part of the book, because, you know, on the one hand, I don't want to say, nor was it true that, you know, I had no power whatsoever in these positions. I certainly had a range of decisions that I could make, and the authority to make decisions that did have real consequence for people who, you know, doubtless felt that I had unlimited power in the positions I had. But I did want to call attention to, you know, the limits of power, the fact that when you're in these positions, you really do begin to take much more seriously a broader sense of who are the, you know, who make up the constituencies of the university, what the different kinds of interests that make it up are, what the range of goals are, and the extent to which there are very different ways of approaching and thinking about the university if you move out of a particular department and the faculty meetings that take place there and the kind of often very uniform sense of what a university should be. And I have to say this having been, you know, in departments and even a department chair for a while, when you're sitting in a department, you think, you know, what has the university done for me recently? Is, you know, am I getting the kind of allocations for new faculty positions or for graduate students or resources to, you know, teach a better major or whatever, you know, in a broader kind of context in which you really aren't thinking about the needs of the chemists or the business school or other kinds of entities across the university. So, you know, it's partly, you know, that sense of the complexity and scale of the university that I wanted to remind people what wherever they are situated in the university, you know, changes the way in which you have to think as an administrator. And of course, there are other kinds of constraints. In a public university, there are even more constraints because you're being looked at by the governor, you're being looked at by the state legislature. But even in private universities, and we've seen this recently, you get evaluated constantly by alumni, by donors, by boards of trustees, and there are limits to what you can do. You know, it's in a way, and you generalize this to think about different kinds of fields. You know, I remember, you know, many of my friends were deeply frustrated during the presidency of Barack Obama by, you know, thinking on the one hand that they shared so much with him, but then he didn't go, you know, completely all out to pursue the kind of progressive agenda that they thought he shared with them, and that they believed that, you know, had he simply decided to follow, would have, you know, changed the nature of American politics. But I was always so struck by the extent to which, you know, he had to focus. He had to say, well, I'm going to work on healthcare. And if I work on healthcare, that's going to mean that other things I'm going to do are going to be much more difficult. And I have to, work very hard to accommodate different kinds of interests and to be responsible to the full electorate. Now, we've seen our politics, you know, change a bit in the years since then. And I think, you know, there could be perhaps on the part of some of these people I'm referring to more appreciation now in retrospect. But even in the most powerful position in the country and indeed in the world, I think there are constraints. And I tried to suggest some of them and give some texture to that in my account of what it was like to be a chancellor at UC Berkeley.
And I think almost everyone, while there are plenty of people who disagree about higher education, one thing almost everyone can agree on is that things are tough. I mean, if we look at just something as basic as public confidence, 2015, a Gallup poll finds 57% of Americans with confidence in higher ed. In 2023, it was down to around 36%. And that's before the plagiarism scandal and the thing with Harvard's former president, Claudine Gay, and the anti-Semitism allegations and all that. So I'm sure if we did it today, it'd be even worse. Why do you think so many Americans now just seem to have so little faith in higher education?
I think there are several reasons for this. And some of them have to do with the very specific political history that we've been living through over the last decade in particular. And I would date it in particular, I think, to the economic crisis of 2008, 2009, which led to both a kind of major shock to the system, but also to growing inequality, an increasing sense on the part of many that the system is rigged, the, you know, clear observation that there's a kind of growing chasm between the haves and the have-nots, between the very elite and everybody else. And they see this reflected in the world of higher education, where you have, you know, massive endowments at places like Harvard, Yale, and Stanford. And then you have, you know, local community colleges and state colleges struggling for resources and yet, you know, not getting any of the kind of either prestige or recognition for the work they do in their local communities to actually try to provide accessible and affordable higher education. But you could even take the story back further, because in a way, and indeed the Berkeley story I tell has some examples of this, I think, that are pretty important. You could go all the way back to the 1960s, because, of course, there was a lot of skepticism about American universities in the 60s. And that skepticism, that sense of, you know, the universities are out of touch, they're not reflecting the core values of America and the like, actually goes back to, in some fundamental sense, the free speech movement that took place at UC Berkeley in 1964. And an up-and-coming politician who decided to run for governor in 1966, Ronald Reagan, actually made Berkeley into the primary issue of his campaign. He said that if he elected, he was going to clean up the mess at Berkeley. And, you know, he talked a great deal about what he saw as the decline of American universities, the decline of morals that was reflected in those universities, the kind of inattention of the faculty to real issues in the world, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, the claim that, you know, most faculty were Marxists and communists and working against the interests right. of the average American and indoctrinating the youth and so on and so forth. But, you know, he did get elected. First thing he did was to fire the president of the University of California, Clark Kerr, who had been the first chancellor of UC Berkeley back in the '50s. And, you know, and then of course, you know, the protests and clamor on the university campuses around Vietnam, Cambodia, civil rights, et cetera, it just kind of kept universities in the news for a long time. It was pretty chaotic back then. So, you know, that was the beginning point. I think things did calm down. But I also know that in the 1980s and 90s, there was a concerted effort on the part of certain very conservative interests, exemplified in the work that was being done in think tanks like the Goldwater Institute, for example, that began to really try to make a move to bring conservatism back into the mainstream fold of the university to attack what they saw as the left-wing extravagance of many university faculty and administrators. And there were efforts really over decades that were made to, you know, to go after the university. But in the same process of trying to change the politics of college campuses, the curriculum, there were debates over, you know, the college curriculum that came out in particular when Alan Bloom wrote The Closing of the American Mind in the late 1980s, and it became a best-selling book in the New York Times. You know, this idea that, you know, if we only went back to teaching the classics of, you know, the great stories and epics and literature of the Greeks and the Romans, we could, you know, we could have a college campus that was training, you know, future leaders in a way that we would respect and perhaps admire, as opposed to what we were getting. But, you know, that's continued, and that just got amped up after 2008, 2009. And we've seen, you know, some of that in recent years. And I saw some of it at Berkeley during my chancellorship, when there were organizations that were, some of which associated, say, with Breitbart News, that were funding controversial speakers to go around and speak on campuses like Berkeley's, precisely to cause foment and to try to, you know, create chaos around these issues that, of course, began to be talked about having to do with free speech, you know, the actual openness of college and university campuses to right-wing views, or even just, you know, conservative views. So I see this as a kind of continuous story that then, you know, completely, in some sense, you know, gets exacerbated by the pandemic and all the kind of roiling that's taken place around science, around elite institutions, around, you know, anything that in some sense is seen as part of the deep state, or, you know, the associated institutions that are claimed to be part of that. And of course, you know, a lot of that is because of the kind of rhetoric that people like Donald Trump have made now part of the mainstream of our American political discourse.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free Bright Side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
You mentioned this idea that universities are full of, you know, communist, Marxist, left-wing indoctrination. And certainly that is the common view, particularly for the social sciences and humanities. And in the book, you talk about at one point this small but vocal group who bemoan the idea that diversity doesn't mean an equal number of right-wing professors as those on the left, assuming bizarrely that the mainstream political spectrum in the U.S. should be the measure of the university's intellectual diversity. And so I could hear a conservative reading that and saying, well, hold on a second. Why is it bizarre for me to expect that the intellectual diversity of our top universities, shouldn't that actually reflect what we see in the general public? And I could see that same conservative saying, and in fact, isn't that what most universities are trying to do when it comes to ethnic and racial diversity? And isn't intellectual diversity really more important to a university than some sort of demographic diversity? And I'm sure you have some thoughts on this, and I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, thanks for the question. It's a good question, and it demands, you know, to be taken seriously. So I did write those words, and let me try to explain what I had in mind. First, I think my sense that, you know, you don't want to hire a faculty around a distribution of views that is part of the general American electorate, because, of course, you're hiring a professional group of people who have been certified, whether in physics and chemistry or in political science and literature, to be specialists in a particular field. And, you know, I hate to say this, but they're just, you know, there's an uneven distribution of this kind of, you know, this kind of lifestyle choice and this kind of interest, which doesn't map nicely onto American political categories. I can't, for example, imagine that there are very many adherents, say, of the MAGA side of the Republican Party today who would be in almost any of the disciplines that exist, not just the humanities and humanistic social sciences. So, you know, what I meant to suggest is that, you know, I think that's the wrong measure for the diversity of the faculty around intellectual issues. Now, it is true that in terms of both faculty and student body, people like me and university administrators have certainly tried to diversify both cohorts and bring in more and more people who come from underserved backgrounds, whether in relationship to being a member of an underrepresented minority or coming from a lower socioeconomic position, et cetera, et cetera. But even there, I think the sense is that, if you look at the numbers, universities like Berkeley still haven't, by any stretch of the imagination, begun to mirror society at large. It was about, breaking down the extent to which, back when I started, the faculty was mostly not just white, but male. So, we've made a lot of efforts to diversify that because it's been seen as important. But that doesn't mean necessarily that people you're hiring who will come from different kinds of backgrounds and positions and perspective and have different perspectives are going to, have one perspective per identity position. And actually, I think one of the things we've been striving to do in the university world is increasingly break down that connection between who you are and what you think. And I think that's an important issue. I'm much more concerned, though, with what it would mean to really open up the criteria that we use to recruit faculty instead of just trying to recruit both faculty and students, for that matter, who think like we do as senior members of the faculty. So I actually do believe that we have to be much more open and much more adventurous, in the way in which we think about hiring, think about recruiting, think about bringing people into the university. And that does entail a certain measure of viewpoint diversity. I think we need to have people who think about literature differently. We need to have people who think about different kinds of philosophical positions differently. And I think that, sometimes the notion that all hiring decisions, all curricular decisions are going to be made within single departments fails to capture the broader perspectives that would come if you really did bring together faculty from different parts of the university and say, what do you think would add something to the mix of faculty you have in this particular part of the university? So I'm definitely in favor of more diversity, and I do believe that there's been a tendency to hyper-professionalize the academy in a way that has imposed a certain level of uniformity that is unhelpful when you actually begin to think about the openness of the university to internal debate. But that debate still has to follow certain kinds of rules and protocols that require a deep commitment to scholarship, to scientific research, to the scientific method, and to things that people basically have to sign on to, and which doesn't necessarily mean that you have people from every part of the political spectrum.
Well, it seems to me that what's also maybe even more important is a commitment to sort of the open-minded and free exchange of ideas. And I think how in recent years, we've seen a trend toward more and more schools requiring applicants for jobs to put together what are called DIE diversity statements, how they would contribute to the diversity that their experiences in that. And it seems to me that in looking at that, one might actually emphasize contributions and a commitment to viewpoint diversity along with that, if that's a direction that universities want to go in. Maybe there could be more of that, and that would be a good thing for the university in general.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that we need to broaden the way we think about diversity and certainly be more capacious in the way in which we, ask potential candidates, whether to be students or to be hired as faculty, to think about their contributions, which is to say, to bring, a different kind of voice, a different kind of view, a different kind of perspective to the subject at hand. And one of the things I did when I was at Columbia, when I was much more involved because I was a dean, not a chancellor, in faculty hiring, was to hire a number of people who were primarily novelists, but to come to teach English literature. And, you know, at the first mention of some of these names, you know, people in the department would say, well, you know, they don't have a right. PhD in literature. Are you sure that, you know, they're not just going to come in and trash what critics do? You know, there's a big difference between the critic and the writer. And, well, you know, then I suggested we recruit, for example, Colm Tóibín, an Irish novelist who happens to have written extraordinary novels about major literary figures, including Henry James and Thomas Mann, but also written a great deal about Irish literary culture in essays and even a couple of books that go beyond his fictional output. And, you know, as soon as he came into the picture, people talked to him and said, oh, yes, this would be a good idea. And, you know, I thought that was great. And he's still teaching one semester every year at Columbia. He spends the rest of his year in Dublin. But he adds enormous, you know, strengths to great English department, but with a very different sensibility about the nature of literary, right, you know, of literature being a producer as well as a critic of literature.
When I think about some of the major issues that are embroiling many campuses now, I think about speech issues and uninviting speakers or shouting down speakers, things like that. And you address this in multiple places in the book. And at one point, you talk about the belief of some people, usually on the left, that free speech can only really be exercised by people in power. And so universities saying, well, we're committed to open debate, that invariably ends up sort of privileging dominant views because the playing field is uneven to start with. And do you think, I feel like I have a certain amount of sympathy for that, but it's a real thorny issue. And I wanted to get your take on that view that you refer to and how universities can sort of cope with that or grapple with that.
It's a real problem, and it's good of you to identify it, because I think it does raise some really critical but quite thorny problems and questions. Now, on the one hand, I certainly accept that, you know, that, and we talked about this before, that positions of power do change the way in which people can be allowed to enable to exercise their speech rights. You know, some people have louder microphones than others, and certainly there's not just greater access to a microphone, but a greater confidence when a microphone is given to you, I suppose, in terms of these kinds of power differentials. On the other hand, the whole premise of the university is that people come together and share a commitment to knowledge, to truth, to exploration, to discovery, that requires that they argue about, you know, these kinds of issues, whether it's the interpretation of an historical event or the nature of change over time in the history of physics or in biology laboratory as to whether or not it would be advisable to continue the kinds of experiments with gene editing that might lead to designer babies at some point, if also produce a cure for something like Huntington's. And you want to be able to be assured that, you know, that people, whoever they are, whether they're, you know, at the lab bench, in the back row of the classroom, or, you know, sitting in the administration hall, have the capacity to be heard, and to be heard in a way that is respectful, that is engaged, and that allows different kinds of views, perspectives, and opinions to really get heard. So look, it's never going to be a level playing field. It's not a perfect world. We know how skewed things can be, but the university has to acknowledge that. It even has a lot of people studying that on the one side, while at the same time, you know, exercising the kind of open forum that, you know, it was hard earned. I mean, even going back to the free speech movement at Berkeley in 1964, to really be able to say this is what is fundamental to a university. Now, there are political opinions that people hold within universities, and they should be able to express those views outside of classrooms and so on and so forth. And in public universities, we're in fact mandated by our adherence to the First Amendment to allow people to speak regardless of what their view is. And of course, there, you know, the question is always, you know, at what point does free speech become hate speech? And is hate speech really protected by the First Amendment? And of course, a lot of hate speech is, not all of it. But by the same token, if you start saying, well, I'm going to listen to, you know, somebody who some, you know, folks think of as being far left, because I agree with those views, but I'm going to shout down anybody who comes from the far right and not let them speak, well, you're actually violating the terms of the First Amendment. And if you translate that then into the scholarly domain, and you begin to say, you know, there are only certain kinds of views that we can accept as serious, you have to be able to back that up, not by a political judgment, but by using the nature of academic reason and, you know, and the high standards of academic debate to make your case and sustain it. So, you know, I did myself get shouted down from various stages at different times. I certainly was presiding over Berkeley when Milo Yiannopoulos came to town and was shut down by a group of Antifa who marched into the campus and basically started attacking the student union where he was going to speak. And I've seen, you know, the kind of worst side of this effort to control speech by shutting down speech you don't like. And to me, it is anathema and totally opposed to the spirit of the university. Does that mean that, you know, sitting around the university and, you know, at a seminar table where, you know, there are people from different kinds of backgrounds with different levels of authority, that it's going to, you know, feel like a completely open and democratic world, you know, when there's some people who know a lot more than others and some people who have done, you know, much more work in their fields than newcomers? No, it's not going to be perfect. But you have to follow certain kinds of ideals. Otherwise, you're going to not just fall short of ideals. We all do that. But you're going to actually sacrifice the fundamental value of the university for our society at large.
Earlier, you referred in a way to sort of that the haves versus the have-nots of higher education, and that being perhaps part of the reason why people have lost faith. And there's this old saying, you've heard it, that if you look at its balance sheet, it seems like Harvard's basically a hedge fund that offers some courses. And you know, you take a look at Harvard's endowment, somewhere over $51 billion. And even over time, if we just look at the endowments of, say, the top 50 schools, over the last 20 years, they've grown from like 143 to $563 billion. You know, and so I think people are looking at this sort of thing at the top universities and saying, what are they doing with all this money? I mean, and obviously you can't answer for all of them, but you have a sense of that landscape. And so how do you respond to people who say, well, they're just hoarding all this money essentially and not doing the good that they could do with it?
Well, the first thing to say about these endowments is that they are almost all of them restricted. So, you know, the endowment is made up of thousands and thousands of individual gifts, each of which has a gift agreement and effectively a contract dictating how the money that is earned out of the endowment is going to be spent or can be spent. So, you know, people give money to universities. They gave money to Columbia and they give money to Berkeley to support student financial aid. And we at Columbia certainly relied on that kind of income that we got from our endowment to establish what effectively was a discount rate for students of close to 50%. That is to say, for every dollar we charged in tuition, we actually only collected half that because the rest was made up of income off the endowment. So, you know, there's that. But, you know, people have given gifts to support particular kinds of programs about which they've, you know, been deeply concerned. There are programs in, you know, I started in South Asian studies. There were people who would give money specifically for supporting, you know, a seminar in the study of India or in the study of, you know, Armenian history or whatever it might be. And those monies can only be used for those purposes. And furthermore, you can only use the income from the endowment. So the endowment is meant to be in perpetuity. So it's money that is given to the university, which they cannot spend the principal of and can only spend the income. So it grows. And in fact, it's supposed to grow because, of course, there's inflation. And there's also, you know, years when the income from investments is lower than others. So you have to average it over time. So you can come up with effectively what is a spend rate of around 5% of the total endowment, which is, you know, effectively how universities have been planning on the way they use the endowment money. Now you can look through the endowment and you can see, you know, what you might think are things that have been put aside for programs you don't care about. But those were the terms under which people gave money. And that's what I mean when I say the endowment is restricted.
Yeah.
So, university can have a lot of money and they can't spend it for purposes that are, you know, outside of the contract. So, you know, there was a time when Yale had quite a bit of money in their endowment, but they also had these old buildings and all the roofs were beginning to fall apart. And there were, you know, major leakage and damage and dining halls in some of the old colleges in New Haven. And there was no money to use to fix the roof. So, you know, the appearance of the endowments obviously is something that is at odds with how people generally understand how they're used. That being said, you know, Harvard, Princeton, Stanford have enormous endowments. And, you know, one of the things that I did at Berkeley was to try to build an endowment there because we were, you know, we had so much less money that was available for some of the kinds of purposes that we really needed, especially since we were competing with Harvard and MIT and, you know, the other great private universities that had so much more money. So we were trying to raise money and we're trying to build our endowments. And we look at those big endowments and say, well, you know, how long is it going to take us to catch up? And feel frustrated by that. But it's not quite the way it seems.
Now, there's another critique. There are plenty of critiques of higher ed, but one other one focuses on administrative bloat, inefficiency. You hear this not just from outside, but from inside the academy. Professors talk about this all the time, I know. Let me give you an example. On data that I was able to find on UC Berkeley, it looks like to me that UC Berkeley has more managers on the payroll than full-time faculty. And I'm just wondering, what do you see as driving this, if you don't want to call it administrative bloat, growth of administration, if you will? And do you think that critics who say, well, there's just universities are too top heavy, do they have a point?
So let me just begin by the general kind of question and problem, which was also part of your question about endowments. And that is really related to the cost of higher education. You know, the cost of college has clearly gone up and up and up and up. It's gone up not just in the privates, it's gone up in the publics. And even at a place like Berkeley, where, you know, for a long time, it really didn't cost very much to go to college. In fact, the governor, when I was chancellor, Jerry Brown, said repeatedly to me, he said, you know, when I went to college, I only paid $70 a semester. Of course, I said to Governor Brown in reply that those were days when the state actually paid 70% of our budget. Yeah. And now they're only contributing about 12% of the overall budget. So I said, if you give us more money, we'll lower the rate of tuition. But even so, you know, I mean, and you know, of course, that the two sectors that have seen the greatest increases in cost in the U.S. are education, higher education, and healthcare. Even so, you know, the upward pressures on cost and the issues that is raised for accessibility and the kinds of real concerns it's raised for students who take vast amounts of you know, loans and debt and then, you know, can't pay it back has been part of what has really created, I think, this growing disaffection with the university, this idea that they have all this money on the one side, but they basically are, you know, gouging tuition and charging usurious rates for what they offer, and then saddling people for, you know, for years with crippling debt. So, you know, there really are a lot of issues here. And the question about administrative bloat, and I'll use the word too, is a question that, you know, goes along with that. You know, how many administrators do you need to keep a university going and, you know, keep the lights on and change the bulbs and the like? There has been enormous growth in administrative ranks. Now, there are, for the most part, good reasons for that. For example, a lot at Berkeley, a lot of the so-called managerial administration actually worked directly with students. You know, at Berkeley, there are 40,000 students and fewer than 2,000 tenure track faculty. So, you know, the faculty don't serve as advisors for students. They don't offer mental health services for students. They don't do a lot of the things that students need. And when you have those kinds of numbers, they need really in ways that drive your hiring up significantly. And by the same token, even faculty. I mean, if you go to a department like one of the ones that I was in at Berkeley, the history department, I mean, there are a number of administrators in the department who are serving faculty interests and helping them get reimbursement for expenses and helping them, you know, do all kinds of things that are part of their work in the university. So it's not as if the administration is just serving administrative ends. They're actually supporting students. They're supporting faculty. They work with alumni. And in the case of a public university, they also work with the state government, because that's an important part of the public set of relationships that a university has, and you have to be able to engage that public seriously. And of course, there are also people out there trying to raise money, and that becomes a growing group as well in the so-called advancement or development kinds of fields. In addition to that, universities, of course, are major centers of research, and especially in many science and engineering fields, that research goes along with federal funding that has very strict guidelines around compliance. And research administration has been a growing area of administrative hiring, and it's actually critical for bringing in huge resources from the federal government to support research that's being done on things that have been transformational in American life at the level both of, you know, what we're seeing now in terms of computation, artificial intelligence, at the level of healthcare, new discoveries around drugs and around treatments for diseases that, you know, we all suffer from or know someone who suffers from and want desperately to see cures for. So, you know, there's a great deal that you can say is just, you know, part of running a major university that both has lots of students, undergraduates and graduate students, and lots of research activity. Okay, but now you sent me some numbers that came out of the University of California. And, you know, one thing I would say is that in the University of California, you have 9 campuses that serve undergraduates. You have 10 campuses that are part of the university system that includes the University of California in San Francisco, which is largely a medical school and doesn't teach undergraduates. But you also in Oakland have the office of the president that has a kind of parallel bureaucracy for running the system as a whole. And you, I think, could argue, and some of the numbers that you sent me, I think, could be used really in the service of this argument, that you don't need as many people off campus as they have, and that there's a lot of duplication. And there have been efforts over the years to really look seriously at that office and cut down the numbers and the costs associated with it. And I think, you know, I think it actually is incumbent on all university administrators to really, really think hard about every administrator who is brought in. Are they really serving the overall purpose of the university, or do they just become, you know, as it were, additional helpmates for other administrators who are creating work that isn't fundamental or absolutely necessary? But that would be part of a larger effort, I think, to identify and control costs and really take seriously the concerns of students, parents, and the American public at large, that we need to do far more to control the cost of higher education.
Now, there are a lot of people on the right who feel that universities, particularly public universities, shouldn't be taking positions on controversial political, social issues, you know, taking sides in the culture wars, if you will. For example, after the Dobbs decision, University of California President Michael Drake issued a statement in which he said, for nearly 50 years, people in the United States have had the right to make private, informed choices about their health care and their futures. I am gravely concerned that today's U.S. Supreme Court decision removes that right and will endanger lives across the country. This decision overturns decades of legal precedent and could pave the way for other fundamental rights to be removed. It's a fairly strong statement, and just one that just an example of many taken from the system in which, you know, in which you work. What do you think about the universe? Do you feel that's taking sides in the culture wars, and do you feel that's appropriate for especially public universities to do?
Yeah, good question. Well, you know, this has been a hot button issue, obviously, of late, around in particular the events that happened on October 7th, and then the Israeli invasion of Gaza, and the kind of issues around, you know, what kinds of statements university presidents and leaders should make. You know, many donors have criticized them for not making statements that have moral clarity, although, of course, you know, one person's moral clarity is not necessarily the same as somebody else's.
Yeah.
But you're right to point to this as an issue that I think affects both public and private universities and is not really sufficiently resolved at this point. There have been some people who have been calling for complete neutrality. And in fact, the call for neutrality goes back, or institutional neutrality, I should say. The call for neutrality goes back in some ways to the Calvin report that was made to the University of Chicago back in 1967. Now, at that particular moment in history, and I've been in the 60s before in our conversation today, but at that particular moment in history, the effort was to, in some sense, protect the university from having to comment about things like the war in Vietnam. And so it was an extreme recommendation for institutional neutrality. And the argument behind it was that it was, if administrators speak, it might have a chilling effect on others within the university and discourage people from expressing their own points of view, as well as, you know, simply being inappropriate, since universities are places where people develop and express their views, but of different kinds. And so if the university has one view, it's going to, in some sense, create a kind of orthodoxy, at least against which people would be reacting, if not feeling chilled with respect to. So, you know, there was a lot to recommend this recommendation made by the Calvin Report. But it turns out it's a little more difficult in practice. And so, you know, in many cases, administrators have articulated the values of the university that include not only free inquiry, but things like, you know, a welcoming, inclusive environment for students from different kinds of backgrounds. And these have been consistent with, you know, the basic principles of the university, which is to bring as many people in as possible to provide them with the opportunities of higher education. And yet, you know, even a statement about, say, inclusivity maps onto certain kinds of political positions in our current political moment, right? So that it is not necessarily consistent with being fully neutral. So then the question becomes where you draw the line. Now, I strongly believe that it was not something I should do to articulate, say, for example, a foreign policy on the part of a university. And that, you know, my basic commitment was to, for example, work with universities in different parts of the world, work with academics in different parts of the world, work with scientists in different parts of the world, regardless of the politics around it. And, you know, and for that reason, in fact, I was opposed to boycotting academics and universities from any place, whether one had major differences of opinion or not, because it was precisely to keep those kinds of channels of communication and interaction and engagement open that the university, in some sense, was made for. But, you know, I guess you could argue that President Drake, when he made that statement, is talking about questions of health. And we've seen that the Supreme Court decision around abortion has actually led to major, major issues around the health care of individuals who are not being served when they are in certain kinds of medical conditions and situations that become, you know, become impossible to address under the conditions of the Supreme Court judgment. But you're right, it's a strong statement, and I certainly accept his view that this is a major problem and issue, while at the same time I concede the premise of your question, which is that, you know, there's a kind of slippery slope. If you make too many kinds of statements that seem to map onto the culture wars, you're then, you know, giving fuel to the critique that, you know, these universities are basically, you know, left-wing institutions that don't tolerate conservative views. So again, I'm not giving you a straight up yes, no answer. I apologize for that. But I am saying that I think that there have to be serious conversations among university administrators about the limits of what we say in order not to chill debate, but yet that nevertheless adhere to some fundamental values and principles that that we can agree are in fact fundamental to the success of the university.
Well, I could easily and happily talk with you for at least another hour, but I know we have reached the end of our time. And so we will stop here. I just want to say, Professor Dirk, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you so much, Mike, for your interest in talking with me. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for listening to this Politics Guys interview. If you're not already a supporter of the show, I hope you'll consider becoming one, because without our supporters, we wouldn't be able to do this. And when you become a supporter, you get not just that warm, fuzzy feeling knowing that you're supporting a good cause. I like to think we're a good cause. But you also get stuff like ad-free versions of everything we put out. You get our supporter-exclusive midweek show, the full length of that, not just the preview. And you also get to be part of our Discord group if you want. And there's always some interesting conversations going on there. At the $10 a month level or more, you get to actually be part of the episodes Jay and I do, if that's something you're interested in. So there's a lot of stuff, is what I am saying. And I hope you'll consider checking it out. And to do that, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you want to support us on Venmo, we're at Politics Guys. You can also support the show through PayPal. And all of our support links are always in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And as always, I want to close with a very special thank you to our wonderful executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Moreno, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.